This is Voices from Appalachia Radio Show, sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University. I'm Brian Staggers, and here's your host, Bianca Eisen.
The late Robert C. Byrd served West Virginia in the House of Representatives and the Senate for the better part of 57 years. In his decades-long career, Byrd held various leadership positions, including Democratic Whip, Majority Leader, Minority Leader, and President pro tempore. Although Senator Byrd's long career wasn't free of controversy, he is often remembered fondly in West Virginia and the greater Appalachian region. Senator Byrd was passionate about his work and the people of West Virginia, which left little time for other hobbies. However, Senator Byrd was passionate about music and incredibly talented at playing the fiddle, so much so that he released an album titled U.S. Senator Robert Byrd, Mountain Fiddler. Dr. Ray Smock, former U.S. House of Representatives historian and longtime director of the Robert C. Byrd Center for Congressional History and Education, sat down to discuss Robert C. Byrd's life, legacy, and the man behind the title with Michaela Barnes, a history major and Appalachian Studies minor and new master's graduate student in the 4+1 program at Shepherd University.
I've been asked to talk about Senator Byrd. And of course, it's my favorite subject here. We have Senator Byrd's vast archive here, all his office papers and his personal papers, family photographs, and all kinds of interesting things. And the thing about Senator Byrd is that he will always be someone worthy of study and worthy of public interest, because he's a very complicated American, and aren't we all? Biographers look for people who have controversy, difficulty, things to overcome, and changes, dramatic changes, and those make the greatest biographies. So the great biography on Senator Byrd is yet to be written, and we have several people that are working on that kind of a project now, and there have been books about Senator Byrd, but none of them try to get into the man behind the scenes, and not only the great senator, but the man of humble origins in West Virginia. There are almost so many stories I don't know where to begin, but certainly his humble origins. You know, we're going through a pandemic right now, but his life was shaped by the great flu epidemic of 1918 through 1920. And his mother died during that epidemic. And he was given to his aunt and uncle to raise. And so he was born with the name of Cornelius Sales, and in North Carolina. And then moved as a very young man, a young infant, to West Virginia, and grew up in the coal fields of West Virginia, where his uncle Titus Byrd was a coal miner. Senator Byrd took the name of his uncle and aunt, and later joked about his own name. He said, "Can you imagine a senator named Corny Sales?" So that's how he would be nicknamed, he thought. But Senator Byrd's growing up in the coal fields of West Virginia, starting businesses, as he worked as a grocer. He met his wife, who was the daughter of a coal miner. And he was always proud of that. When he talked about his life, he always said, one of the proudest things he said was, "I married a coal miner's daughter." And they had a long and wonderful life together. But Senator Byrd was ironically, and this is one of those things that the biographies love, his uncle was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. He got involved with the Ku Klux Klan in the late 30s, early 40s. And of course, later, when he became a public man, those who ran against him used that as a derogatory part of his career, and it was, except that Senator Byrd spent his whole life apologizing for that past. And that kind of redemption, I think, is worthy of exploration. He was not, as they say, unreconstructed. He did not stick with those ideas, with those the racism of that was so common in the United States, North and South, in those days. And of course, it's still with us. It hasn't disappeared. In that case, in that event, Senator Byrd overcame what a lot of Americans still have not overcome. And I think that's a fascinating part of the story. He said often, and he said it to me on a number of occasions, he said it in his biography, that being a member of the Ku Klux Klan would always be an albatross around his neck. And I think it will remain so. But it, like everything else in a person's life, you have to keep things in some kind of a context. While he opposed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and regretted that later, he went on to become a champion of civil rights, and the NAACP gave him one of his highest ratings in terms of the legislation that he passed that helped African Americans. And one of the least known aspects of Senator Byrd's early career on the Hill, Capitol Hill was quite segregated itself. And there were you have 100 senators and 435 House members, and only about a dozen of those offices were integrated, had African Americans on the staff, and Senator Byrd was one of the first. And he was also the first to nominate African Americans to be members of the Capitol Police Force. So again, when we study a person's whole life, a man who lived 90 years and achieved the high levels of government service, the balancing of all the various aspects of his life becomes the challenge of any biographer. And of course, that's the challenge of any of us when we look at anybody's life, including our own. The complexity is always there, and the idea is to create a narrative out of it that makes sense, and also, whenever possible, can be truth.
Senator Byrd, he obviously had his flaws, some controversies in his career, but I would say, relatively, he is remembered very fondly. How do you think he accomplished that?
He eventually accomplished the reputation of being one of the great senators, one of the great statesmen, and also, of course, the longest-serving senator. And he consciously worked at improving himself and trying to become a better leader. He didn't even get a law degree until he was already serving in the Senate. He loved the discipline of the classroom, and that was important. And he didn't have all that much of it when he was a young man, went to a small a school, but never was educated formally until much later in life. And that formal education helped him. It expanded him. As he began to study the Senate, as he became a member of the Senate, here he was, a guy from the Appalachian coal fields, who is hanging around with senators, some of them with names of the wealthiest, famous, most prominent American families in history. And I think he had maybe somewhat of an inferiority complex. And the way he overcame that was to simply use education as power. And when he went into a hearing room in the Senate, he was ready. He always took home, anybody that saw him leave the Capitol Hill at the end of the day, he always had two or three big binders under his arms. And these would be things that he'd be studying for the next day's hearings. And he knew that if he knew as much or more than anyone else in the room about the subject at hand, that would give him equal power or even greater power to make things happen. So nobody worked harder at being a senator. I asked, he could do these amazing things from in his floor speeches without notes, in the early days especially, and all the way up until the 1980s, early 90s. And I asked him one time if he had a photographic memory. And he said, no, I don't think so. Some of his staff thought he did. But he said, I work hard. When I find something that's worth saying again, I work hard at remembering it and trying to use it. And of course, later he wrote a history of the Senate of the Roman Republic, and it was published as a book. And the book was based on speeches that he gave in the Senate, and he gave those from memory. He didn't even have a note with him. And that's one of the most remarkable books you're ever going to read on the history of the Roman Senate. And he wanted to study the Roman Senate to see what it would tell him about our times in our Senate. And that kind of study we have in our files here at the Byrd Center. We have all his notes that he took when he studied the Roman Senate, underlining passages, writing in the margins, memorize this. And we have his Bibles. He quoted the Bible. He knew the Bible backwards and forwards, the King James Version, because it was so beautiful, the language of the King James Version. And his Bibles are all marked up, underlined, and with marginal notes about his commentaries and also things like I need to memorize this, and he worked so hard, and then when he did do these things, it seemed so natural. It just sort of flowed from him. He was an orator. He was proud to be an orator in the Senate tradition of being a public speaker, he was both fascinated by orators from an early age, and saw that as part of the role of a senator.
So we've talked a little bit about Byrd and what makes him special. Are there any other ways you think that he differs from, like, a common senator or the senators and people from the House of Representatives during his time?
Well, of course, he served in the House, too. He served in... he came up the way a lot of people think you should come if you're going to get into national office. You work... He was in the state legislature, in both the legislature and the state senate, then served in the House of Representatives, and then he served in the Senate. So there was a transition and a learning curve all along the way. I think what he did that a lot of others didn't, especially in more recent times, to see the institution of the Senate as so important, he became the great defender of the institution. He was a stickler about the U.S. Constitution, of course, which he practically had memorized, and believed in it. He would say things like, I have served with 11 United States presidents. I have served under none. In other words, the idea that a Senate is a separate office, it's co-equal branch, it's equal to the president. As a senator, he wants to work with presidents of either party, doesn't matter, but he doesn't work under them, and he's independent of them. He would do little things. We did an oral history not too long ago with the great George Mitchell, who was a leader of the Senate himself, and one of the great negotiators of peace in the Irish Rebellion. The Troubles, and George Mitchell said that Senator Byrd was such a stickler of how to behave in the chamber itself. When you come into the chamber and you want to approach whoever is presiding, you have to sort of walk up a couple of steps to get at the same level. And Byrd said, "Don't do that." And he admonished people to stay below the level of the person that was presiding, out of respect for the body, out of respect for the Senate. You just didn't come up and say, hey, buddy, I slap him on the shoulder. Well, they do that all the time now in both the House and the Senate. But when Byrd was there, you didn't do that. You followed these rules that made the chamber more formal. And that wasn't just to be stuffy. It was to respect the institution.
Do you think we still see and feel his legacy, not only in West Virginia, but in Appalachia as a whole?
We certainly do. Every time you get on any decent highway in West Virginia, it's probably Senator Byrd who found the money for it. Just recently, our current senators, Shelley Moore Capito and Joe Manchin, made a wonderful announcement that the New River Gorge is our newest national park. We have here records where Senator Byrd was working toward that goal as early as the 1960s. You would be hard-pressed to find anybody that had more respect for coal miners and the coal industry, both, than Senator Byrd. But he also knew, and especially later in his life, he argued for diversity in West Virginia. And one of the ways to diverse West Virginia, to recognize its fantastic natural beauty, and to see that as not only of great benefit to West Virginians themselves, but as tourism going forward. The great forests of West Virginia, the mountains, they are actually on the east coast of the United States, one of the great resources for climate stability when you think about it. And also the natural beauty. He worked hard to save the Canaan Valley. He worked to see that the New River Gorge was protected, and eventually, in more recent times since his passing, made a national park. And you can see in the records that we have all the remarkable ideas that he had and how much love he had for the state. He also knew that industry and diverse industry was important. You got to have highways, you got to have infrastructure so that these things can happen. And so the highway system in the state, with Corridor H about to be finally completed after all these years, and he was funding that. I was with him for the dedication of Route 9, which runs through our area here over to the Virginia line. And that took so long, and it was such a complicated effort because of the land arrangements and the way the road had to run so that it was on whatever land they could acquire to make it happen. And those of us who live in the Eastern Panhandle use that road all the time. But when I was with him at the dedication, I said something to the effect that I wonder how much this highway finally cost. It took so long to build. And he shot back at me the exact number in millions of dollars, right down to the penny. he knew these things. They weren't abstractions to him. And he took it personally, that he was very proud that he had acquired the money. We have a cartoon that we have hanging in the office here at the Byrd Center that shows him, at least especially in our area. The cartoon is about the Eastern Panhandle. And it shows him like a Johnny Appleseed spreading. The legend of Johnny Appleseed is he went around and planted apple trees everywhere. And this Johnny Appleseed was planting various government entities and other things that would promote, in highways, things that would promote the development of West Virginia. So I think he was, and some of the effects of his work is still benefiting the state. He was like a Johnny Appleseed. And West Virginia was one of the poorest states in the Union. We needed all this help. We needed this kind of infrastructure, and still do. I don't think we'll find anybody that will match or maybe ever surpass Senator Byrd's love of this state, and because he was an appropriator, he was able to help. They called it pork. His enemies, his political enemies, would say that Senator Byrd is the king of pork. And he would turn that around and say, isn't that a wonderful thing to say about somebody, that I help my state and that I bring money into my state? And of course, as an appropriator, as chairman of the Appropriations Committee, he helped an awful lot of other states with their infrastructure and their earmarks. He believed earmarks were a sign of democracy because it was getting the people exactly what they wanted and what they asked for. It wasn't some abstraction. It wasn't what Washington thought they needed. It was what the people in the state thought they needed. Saw earmarks in that way as a way to democratically help the people.
Senator Byrd's probably greatest passion in life was West Virginia and helping the people of West Virginia. Did he have any other passions outside of legislation in West Virginia that you know of?
Well, of course, he was a great musician. Of course, he took his fiddle with him everywhere he went. Now, outside of West Virginia, some people just figured he was just sort of like a hick because all he did was play a fiddle and everybody was happy and they'd stomp their feet and they would listen to him play music. And he got criticism from, especially from people in New York and writing in the New York Times and all those Eastern establishment folks. But here in West Virginia, the people who came to hear him understood that he was not just some average fiddler. He was a master at the instrument. And I've talked since to many really first-class musicians who play the music of West Virginia and of Appalachia. And they say it's even more remarkable because as a young man, he was trained on the violin. You look at the instrument, a violin is a fiddle, but a violin and the way you're trained formally is different from the way a country fiddle is played. Senator Byrd developed techniques that made his fiddling really special and unique, and the people recognized that. And later musicians recognized it. When he passed, I went to his home, and among, of course, his possessions there, he had a big glass case with a number of fiddles in it. We have a couple of those here at the Byrd Center. It sort of was his symbol. And his passion for music was great. It wasn't just a device to use on the campaign trail. He loved fiddling. Late in life, he was honored by country music people that he was awarded lifetime achievements for his work, and that meant as much to him as anything that he did. So, other than his music, he devoted himself to the work of the Senate. He did not go play golf on the weekends with the other senators. He did not take long family vacations here and there in the other places. He worked. He was a workhorse. He dedicated himself to that work. I don't think you ever met him. You'd ever see him as a narrow person. He was well-rounded, well-read, and always intensely interested in learning.
The Robert C. Byrd is currently memorialized as one of the greatest U.S. senators, honestly one of the greatest figures in U.S. history. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I think he will always be remembered for his defense of the prerogatives of the Senate, his defense of the Constitution. He did a lot of things that aren't so obvious, and of course other senators have done this too. He acted as a liaison for a number of presidents on major international issues and trips. And of course, one of his great achievements with President Jimmy Carter was the passage of the Panama Canal treaties. And now at the time, the idea of turning the Panama Canal over to the country of Panama was considered a bad idea by a lot of people. And even here in West Virginia, a number of people called Senator Byrd a traitor for trying to get rid of what they thought was American property. Well, they didn't understand the treaties. The treaties gave control of the property to Panama, but they also guaranteed U.S. passage and the U.S. defense and other things related to those treaties. But that was one of the most remarkable achievements internationally. And, of course, there were wars and feuds and revolutions and nonsense down there all the time. Since the treaties, it's been, you haven't heard the Panama Canal being a divisive object at all, and it certainly still works to America's interests as well as the rest of the world. So there's things like that that he did, that where he represented the United States and represented the president in some of these activities overseas. And all of that is going to be in the record forever. I don't think anyone will ever beat his record of longevity in the Senate. House and Senate combined, yes, but just in terms of his long Senate career, that's unprecedented, and it probably will be a record that would be pretty hard to break.
Is there anything else you want to mention?
Well, just personally, I would say that Senator Byrd was one of the most remarkable individuals I ever met. I was proud and pleased to work as the House historian for many years. And during that time, I had dealings with Senator Byrd on frequent occasions because we were covering the bicentennial of the Constitution, and he was the leader of that on the Senate side. And I was working with the House and through the Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill, at the time. So I was able to see him in meetings and see him personally and to get to talk to him about the Constitution and about the founding era. I'll tell you one little anecdote. We were having a conversation one time about the Federalist Papers and the founders were the brilliant essays about why we should have this Constitution and why it was structured the way it was. And I said, in Federalist 51, James Madison said, and I quoted whatever it was that I thought James Madison said in that, and Senator Byrd looked at me and raised his eyebrows and said, why, Dr. Smock, that wasn't Federalist 51, that was in Federalist 10. I mean, the fact that he knew that kind of stuff, and of course he was admonishing me, but also teaching me to be a little bit more careful and precise if I'm going to cite the founders.
That was Shepherd University student Michaela Barnes interviewing former U.S. House of Representatives historian and longtime director of Robert C. Byrd Center for Congressional History and Education, Dr. Ray Smock, on the life and legacy of Robert C. Byrd. You can learn more about the Byrd Center by visiting their website at byrdcenter.org. Thank you all so much for joining me, and until next week, I'm Bianca Eisen.
Voices from Appalachia Radio Show is sponsored by the Center for Appalachian Studies and Communities at Shepherd University, with the following created to enhance and develop the cultural and economic life of West Virginia and the Appalachian region. Academic programs that include an Appalachian Studies minor, an interdisciplinary BA, BS undergraduate degree, and a graduate certificate and master's degree in Appalachian Studies at Shepherd University. Celtic Roots and Global Appalachia Study Abroad and Celtic Heritage Series. The Appalachian Heritage Writers in Residence and Writers Award, which support the West Virginia Center for the Books, One Book, One West Virginia, Common Read Selection. The West Virginia Fiction Competition. The Anthology of Appalachian Writers, an annual anthology featuring writing by the Heritage Writer, and poetry, fiction, creative nonfiction, essays, and photography created by Appalachian writers across the region and the world. Voices from the Misty Mountains, NEH, and West Virginia Humanities Council Teacher Institutes, Shepherd Speaks StoryCorps Project, and this radio show, in cooperation with Shepherd University Public Radio Station, WSHC-FM. To learn more about our degree programs or upcoming events, visit us at our website at shepherd.edu/appalachian or at our Facebook page, Appalachian Studies Program at Shepherd.